Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilber, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. Fermentation is the microbial transformation of a food or substrate into a desired food product. And when I think of fermentation, I usually think of bacteria like lactic acid bacteria in yogurt and kimchi, or acetic acid bacteria in vinegar. But microbes just refer to microscopic life. It's just organisms that we can't see with the naked eye. And there are so many other types of microbes in addition to bacteria that can play a role in the fermentation process. So David, do you want to kick us off by giving a little crash course and reminding us of what microbes actually are?
Well, when we think of microbes, we're talking about forms of life that you need a microscope to see. And that includes all sorts of stuff. It includes bacteria, it includes archaea, this other branch of life that everyone used to think was bacteria, but turns out, nope, they are very distantly related. It includes single cells like yeast and protists, things like amoebas and algae, and even like really, really tiny multicellular organisms like tardigrades and like tiny, tiny mites. But in fermentation, we're generally talking about bacteria and yeast. And so to wind the clock back to the dawn of life on Earth, going back almost 4 billion years, you know, probably deep somewhere in a hydrothermal vent, there was the right combination of, you know, like hydrogen sulfide and all sorts of elements being poured out of a volcanic fissure somewhere in the ocean. Life bootstrapped itself into existence using these chemical gradients. And the first organisms would have been bacteria. Then there was a branching event, probably around 500 million years later, like 3.5 billion years ago, that birthed archaea, which are very different to bacteria in some fundamental ways, even though they're both single-celled organisms. And then at some point, there was probably a hybridization event, something scientists like to call endosymbiosis, where an archaea probably tried to consume a bacteria and eat it, but failed to do that. And then lunch started living inside of its host. And that turned into, through mutations, a more complex branch of life called eukaryotes, which we are a part of. So all multicellular life is eukaryotic. We have a cellular nucleus. And even single-celled things like yeast, which are fungi, are more closely related to us than they are to bacteria, even though they live life as single cells. So that's the kind of order of events in this great family tree of life, but it's not linear. It folds back on itself and it tangles and branches cross and merge, but that's kind of the way it rolls through time.
It's beautiful because you mentioned at the beginning these distantly related microbes, and when you say distantly related, that they've been evolving separately for billions of years is kind of, you know, it takes your breath away to think about those time scales. They're kind of incomprehensible. And even within bacteria, just the sheer diversity of these organisms that we think are one group that's very similar, and yet these different species have been doing their own thing for so long. So to talk about the microbes that we use in fermentation, I think quite often we think about bacteria, you know, the ones we use to make yogurt like Streptococcus thermophilus and Lactobacillus delbrueckii. These are, of course, the workhorses of commercial fermented foods originally used for making yogurt, dating way back before people knew they existed. But this other group, fungi, I think are super interesting in all the things they can do. People will know yeast for bread making and beer and wine, but there are a lot of different yeast, Brettanomyces, Candida. And then, of course, there's molds, and sometimes we refer to these as filamentous fungi. Just to remind everyone, you know, these are the eukaryotes. These are not bacteria. These are eukaryotes that are being used for fermentation. You know, the molds really are, I think, what I consider to be the rock stars of fermentation. I mean, they just really can create dazzling flavors and colors, things like aspergillus and rhizopus. And if you've ever enjoyed something like tempeh, you've experienced the magic of molds.
Yeah, and I just have to say that there's nothing like fresh tempeh. That just the difference, being someone that was originally exposed to supermarket tempeh, and then going and trying, you know, these fresh tempeh quinoa and lentil burgers at Popple in Copenhagen or at Fermenter in Portland, and the difference in just the kind of nuttiness and floral notes is mind-blowing. It's night and day. It's not even close to the same product. I mean, David, at this point, you've made so much tempeh and koji in your life. How many pounds do you think you've made in total?
I have made tons. I can't count. I can't even begin to. I mean, I worked in the fermentation lab at NoMa for 5 years. A pretty regular schedule was doing about 50 kilos of koji a week for various, you know, to service the restaurant. But then on top of that, just to keep up with making miso and garums and things like that, because the koji would go into so many other recipes. And, you know, we just tried to always have like a bank of, you know, maybe at least like 100 kilos in the freezer in case there was an emergency at any given time. So that adds up. Like tons and tons of koji in my lifetime. And I still make it, you know, in my lab at Christian Institute, but the occasional batch, and a little bit goes a long way now that I don't work in restaurants anymore. But yeah, they are, you know, I'm in complete agreement with you, Justin. They are the rock stars, the great mycologist Merlin Sheldrake calls them the enzymatic wizards of the natural world. And he's absolutely right. Filamentous fungi are just magicians when it comes down to transforming organic matter into incredibly compelling flavors.
And I'll add there that, you know, I totally agree with the you know, fresh fermented foods just being very different than supermarket versions. But there are incredible misos that you can get at the supermarket that just give you this incredible range of flavors that is just so, I mean, you'd never think you were eating, you know, some sort of plant that has been just fermented by a single species of mold. And, you know, you'd think you're eating some incredible mixture of many ingredients. They're just so flavorful.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we used to only see soybean misos, but now there are also chickpea misos and the use of kind of other legumes as substrates, and they're really delicious. But David, when you were making all these koji ferments at NoMa, were you actually using primarily Aspergillus oryzae, or did you use other filamentous fungi?
Aspergillus oryzae and kind of its kin, Aspergillus soyae, which is primarily used for the production of soy sauces, and some other species within the same genus. We messed around with tempeh a little bit. I mean, it worked great for the burgers, but it never really made the menu in any meaningful way in other realms. Tempeh being an Indonesian filamentous fungi in the genus Rhizopus, and also Monascus purpurus, which is sometimes called red yeast rice. It's not a yeast at all. So we did try to branch out, no pun intended. I remember once we actually contacted the Vesterdijk Fungal Institute, which is like the world's largest nonprofit fungal gene bank in the world. And it's based in the Netherlands. And they would not give us anything fun to play with because we weren't an academic institution. They're like, we're sorry, we don't sell to private individuals. I'm like, come on. But Aspergillus, why do we keep coming back to Aspergillus oryzae? It's just, I don't know. Why are dogs man's best friend? Probably because they're the most malleable, the most useful, the best at the jobs that we needed them to do. You know, it's like in nature, not all things are created equal. And in domestication events, we tend to gravitate around the organisms that act in complement to our needs the best. And whatever it is about Aspergillus's, maybe its speed, maybe it's the enzyme flight that it hosts in its genome, its ability to express that, its genetic plasticity, and the fact that it's been able to transform itself thousands of times over into different strains. I can't settle on any one distinction.
And maybe it's just an accident of history, but it does its job extremely well. And it's been doing its job extremely well for thousands of years. I learned a lot of this in an amazing book that I have to recommend. That's very pertinent to the topic of this episode. But The Arts of the Microbial World, Fermentation Science in 20th Century Japan by Victoria Lee is something that I just stumbled across in my research just by throwing search terms into Google and hoping that I would get a great text out. And I did. She's now an associate professor at the History Department of Ohio University. It is one of the most thorough English language documentations of Japan's relationship to fungal science, going back, stretching back into tradition before the advent of microbiology as the West understands it, and then how they catapulted themselves as a nation using that traditional knowledge into the 21st century. Really, really an amazing book for any fungal nerds out there. And we do have another fungal nerd with us today. And that's, you know, why we're having this conversation at all. So we might as well get to our guest, Dr. Bayou Hill Maini.
Today's guest is Dr. Bayou Hill Maini, a postdoctoral fellow at the Joint Bioengineering Institute at the University of California, Berkeley, who's currently working in the lab of Jay Kiesling. Bayou, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you completed your PhD in chemical biology in Emily Balkas's lab, where you were working on microbial engineered enzymes in the gut microbiome, but now you're working on novel edible mycelium engineering. Can you tell us about that? How did you go from the gut microbiome to fungal foods?
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be here. You know, to kind of tell you the story, I want to go back before the gut microbiome to where I really started, because it kind of illustrates how I've really come full circle, I think. So my journey to Berkeley and where I am today really started in the kitchen. So when I was very young, I fell in love with cooking. I grew up in a multicultural home, you know, connections all around the world. And for me, food and cooking was a way to understand and connect with where I came from and who I was. So I grew up in Sweden, and I kind of originally came to the U.S. when I was just at turn 18 to work in restaurants, to pursue this passion for cooking full time. You know, I loved it. I loved the exploration, the sense of discovery and learning. And so I worked in restaurants for a bit. And then after that, I ended up going to college. And it was really in college that I kind of made the connection that, okay, you know, I love food, I love cooking, but there's this whole world kind of underlying it, which is science. You know, there's biology, there's chemistry, there's physics. You know, all of it is really manifesting in the food that we eat and how we prepare it. So it kind of is that kind of connection between, you know, understanding food and wanting to go deeper that made me pursue a PhD. You know, my goal was really to say, okay, I spend a lot of time in the kitchens preparing food, thinking about how we make it. I did research on, you know, food science and molecular gastronomy, making weird foams and gels back in the 2010s. And that was really cool. And then I wanted to kind of learn more about what happens about with food in our bodies. And so that led me to the gut microbiome. That led me to kind of think about, okay, when we're eating not only for ourselves, but for trillions of bacteria and other little creatures that live inside us that help us digest the food, extract the nutrients, and influence our health. And so that's what brought me to Harvard. I spent 5 years, you know, learning about microbes in the gut and how they break down food, their enzymes, the species involved. And when I came to Berkeley, I kind of wanted to say, okay, I have this training in microbiology, in biochemistry, you know, really understanding things at a deep level. How can I kind of use this knowledge to circle back to actually making food? And that's what I've been focusing on, is really saying, okay, microbes are incredible. They're incredible chemists. How can we harness them to make food that's tasty, nutritious, but also addressing one of the pressing challenges of our time, sustainability? So that's how I ended up at Berkeley, mycelium, fungi, you know, it all kind of came from that.
So your previous work on the gut microbiome primarily focused on bacteria and how they would break down a food. But now in your fellowship, you focus on fungi as food, which is super cool. And I know you have two papers coming out soon that look at fungi in different ways. The first is going to be characterization of an understudied filamentous fungus. And the second paper is engineering techniques to apply to edible mycelium. Can you give us a little bit of information about this work?
Yeah, so as you're saying, you know, I right now work on filamentous fungi. So just give a brief overview. What are they? They're molds and mushrooms. You know, I think a lot of the public right now are aware of them. You know, we have had TV shows like The Last of Us, you know, kind of highlighting fungi. And, you know, New York Times is writing about them every other week, it seems. So, and there's movies on Netflix, you know, about them. And so there is really exciting kind of understudied creatures that have incredible potential for sustainability. You know, they're good at breaking things down and making new things. And they've been used for thousands of years to make fermented foods all around the world. And I'm really thinking about, okay, we have this long history with fungi, but how can we bring in modern kind of biotechnology tools and modern scientific understanding to really unlock their full potential to make foods that are good for people and the planet? And so my work is really about like reimagining how we use fungi, you know, kind of pushing the frontier, expanding the species that are available to us, the tools that are available to us to make food. And so that has kind of I've kind of pursued that in two different sort of areas that you described. And I have papers in the pipeline coming out soon on this. So the first one is kind of thinking about the challenge of waste upcycling. You know, the food system generates a lot of waste. It's very wasteful. But that waste could maybe be utilized and converted into food so that we waste less and more of the food that we grow reaches our bodies. How do we do that? Well, fungi are really good at growing on waste and converting it into new flavors and nutrients. So that is kind of the big picture challenge. And when I thought about that challenge, I kind of thought, well, we are not the first to think about this. You know, in cultures all around the world, we've had to think about waste and minimizing waste, you know, to get the most out of what we grow. And so that brought me to Indonesia, to a traditional fermented food called oncom. This food is not as well known as the more well-known cousin called tempeh. Tempeh is pretty widely available. People know it's sort of a fungus that grows on soybeans and it makes kind of a meat substitute. Oncom, on the other hand, is made from waste, particularly made from the waste of soy milk production. And so my work has been to say, hey, here's this traditional example, hundreds of years of robust scientific procedures and protocols, making a food that's tasty, that's sustainable. Let's go in and learn about the process at a molecular level. You know, what are the enzymes involved? What are the fungi that are making this possible? And that has led to some really exciting discoveries, for example, of a fungus that was domesticated by humans to convert waste into food. And that opens all sorts of possibilities now for, you know, the broader challenges beyond Indonesia to think about this, you know, kind of pressing challenge that we're facing. So that has been kind of a way to go deep into traditional biotechnology, you know, long history of what I would call scientific practice and experimentation, using our tools, our lenses to understand it and learning about, you know, these natural systems. And then on the other hand, we're kind of thinking about, okay, what if we just expand beyond what's available to us in nature? You know, now we have things like CRISPR-Cas9, which is a genetic editing tool that won the Nobel Prize just a few years ago. How could we utilize these kinds of, you know, very, I guess, precise and exciting engineering tools to say, okay, nature has invented all of this over the course of evolution. Well, how can we now program and direct it into areas and solutions that we want? And there I've particularly focused on developing genetic engineering tools for an edible fungus called Aspergillus oryzae. It's been used for thousands of years to make miso and shoyu and sake in East Asia. And we've developed these like genetic tools to precisely program the chemistry of this fungus. And we've used that to change its flavor and its nutritional value. And it kind of, you know, leads to the possibility, okay, whereas our ancestor might have done this over a 1,000-year timeline, domesticating and genetically changing organisms, we can now program them very rapidly in the laboratory to say, hey, let's make this healthier, let's make it grow better or whatever. And so my area really spans that traditional kind of biotechnology all the way to kind of pushing the frontiers of what might be possible in the future.
So that's amazing. And I love this concept of taking food waste and turning that into, additional food. I think, thinking back to kind of traditional family farms, this always was seen as the job of like pigs or chickens, where you just throw out scraps and, they would consume it and then you turn it into eggs or meat. I think, with industrial agriculture, we've seen how that process can really go awry, both in terms of sustainability, but also in terms of like ethics and things like that. And so I'm wondering if there are additional issues, like just thinking about, fungi serving this role of taking waste and then turning it into something that we can consume, a way of saving this matter and turning it into something edible. Are there additional things you think about? I mean, you mentioned the genetic toolkit. Does it give us more flexibility in terms of what we're able to make as an end product?
Yeah, I think so. I think, these microorganisms are very malleable, and, it's easier to kind of direct their metabolism and their structure than it is to do that of a pig or a cow, maybe, that also operates on a longer time scale. And we also, it's probably a lot less efficient in terms of the energy we put in and what we get out of it. And so I think there's many exciting advantages there to fungi. But I think something you hit on, and I think David is really familiar with, is probably, the flavor possibilities here. And, what happens when we take these organisms and mix them with their new substrates, their new ingredients, right? We can kind of rethink, is it waste or is it just a new ingredient that has its own potential, its own, promise? And I think that is something I'm very excited about, connecting the waste to the fungi and trying to make food.
Yeah, amazing. And actually, I mean, we have the luxury of having a host here who could be one of our guests each week. And I wanted to bring David in kind of with one of these questions, because I remember seeing him speak at a conference a few years ago about a different Aspergillus species that you seemed kind of enamored with in terms of the flavor palette. Remind me the story there.
That would have been Aspergillus luchuensis, which is, as far as I've understood now, a defunct name, a defunct taxonomic classification. Hmm. I think it's supposed to be called Aspergillus aumori v. luchuensis.
I can't keep up. I feel like it changes every week, the renaming.
It does. And you study fungi for a living, Vayu, so you know that it's not even easy to, it's like, oh, well, this one grew clonally, so it looks a certain way, but then it reproduces in like one of its 87 mating types, and then it grows a different way.
Exactly. And then then people said, oh, that's a different species. And it's messy. It's complicated.
The literature is just riddled with these shape-shifting chimeras. But this is a very tasty and long domesticated fungus. It tastes like, to me, I always describe it as a combination of oyster mushrooms, green apple, and grapefruit, like in one thing, grown on rice or barley. It's fun. But I was going to ask you, Vayu, this is super cool research. This is something I could have only dreamed of having access to, like a postdoc who was working full-time on engineering Aspergillus, new flavor specifically. Do you see a pull from industry? I know that, like working in academia can become quite like, oh, this is my field, I'm going deep down. But
yeah,
are there people knocking on your door looking for outlets for some of the things that you're working on? Be it, and this could be restaurants, but also food industry. Are there like soy sauce or sake or miso manufacturers who are like, hey, can you do this for me? Can you engineer this flavor into the foods I produce?
That's a really interesting question. And I feel like it has multiple dimensions. I think on the one hand, there is some skepticism among the big players, traditional, food is a legacy business. There's dominated by a few companies, GMO, genetic programming, that might be a little bit like, well, consumers don't want that. Or, there is that sense of like, like, what's this about? There's a curiosity. They're sort of like, that's cool. But somebody has to maybe adopt it before they step in. But I've had, conversations and a lot of, interactions with some of those companies. I think there's a curiosity. But again, there's a perception that GMO and genetic programming, might not fly well with the public. I've been very encouraged, however, to see, for example, a company called Berkeley Yeast, established here in Berkeley by Jay Kiesing, who I work with, a professor of bioengineering. They engineer yeast, brewer's yeast, you know, been used for thousands of years to make beer and wine. They said let's use CRISPR-Cas9 genetic tools to program the flavor, to program the brewing performance and make it a lot more precise. And they, you know, they're a company that they're surviving. You know, they have a solid business model. They're selling yeast. It's a, you know, quite a sizable market, and people want it because it offers novelty and it offers, you know, consistency. And so I think when we think about these engineered fungi, there could be an element there as well of saying, hey, you know, this kind of magic dust that you sprinkle that sort of works out every, you know, 67% of the time, how can we make that more robust, more precise, and kind of directed to where we want to go? I will say restaurants, particularly fine dining, are very kind of excited about this because I feel like a big driver for those places is novelty, you know, and this is novelty, right? To say, and it gives you sort of agency to direct and decide. So instead of, you know, using the same kind of strain and same thing that everybody else uses, you could sort of have an edge and say, you know, we use this special thing that's been programmed and whatever. And I find that, you know, that I find very exciting, that kind of sort of creative pull a little bit, you know. And I think those restaurants have a really, you know, powerful cultural influence. And I think if they sort of advocate and explore this, it could maybe trickle down a little bit. Finally, I see definitely, you know, more traditional biotechnology industry, places that, you know, rely on fungi to produce enzymes or proteins or, you know, kind of for laundry detergent, Novozymes is an example, for example. There, I think it's more like, oh, yeah, this is cool. You know, we can plug it into our pipeline. But so I think part of what I've discovered is that even if it isn't directly going to end up on our plates tomorrow, I think a role of us academics is a little bit like artists, you know, like to provoke, to inspire thought and say, hey, you know, we can engineer this thing to bleed, as I've done with Aspergillus oryzae. We now have produced heme, so it looks red and it looks kind of like red meat. Is that going to end up on the plate tomorrow? I don't know. But at least it's moving the conversation forward and saying, look, this is even possible. And so if we can't do that as academics, who is? So part of me has kind of landed there and I'm like, you know, when sometimes I feel like, you know, is this really, you know, GMO and regulation or whatever? I'm like, it's still worth doing. And so there's multiple dimensions, I guess, to that question.
To bring this back to, I mean, I love that vision of inspiring. And I think so much is possible with the science that you're doing. I also think about, you know, kind of the classic fungi that have been used for transforming foods and the safety concerns that go along with that. And you mentioned the other species at the beginning that's used to produce onchom. And then of course, Aspergillus oryzae is kind of the workhorse in this field for, you know, as you mentioned, soy sauce, miso, sake. There, you know, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. One, kind of what goes into identifying a fungus that can be, like, do we have to rely on cultures that have consumed these things for, you know, centuries to know that something's safe? Is there another way to go about this? Can we take species that are used now and make them even safer and take away food concerns? Because my understanding is that there's still toxin genes in a lot of these fungi that we use. They're just not expressed. And so you end up with no toxin, but there's still always kind of the concern and the need for monitoring. So I'd love to hear just your comments on both kind of the safety from native ones that we can find, but also how synthetic biology might play a role in it.
That's a really great question. And I think it's a question that, like, doesn't have a super maybe inspiring answer in that, like, you know, historically, it's this historical precedent. You know what I mean? It's like if something was eaten and it has been eaten long enough, then we assume that that fungus is absolutely safe. You know what I mean? However, as you bring up, as something like Aspergillus oryzae, which is used extensively for miso, sake, soy sauce, and sort of other traditional fermentations in East Asia, it still has the capacity, in theory, to produce toxins because it encodes the genes to make toxins. It's just that under all conditions where it has been historically grown, it just lost the ability to produce them. The same thing is true for cheese microbes, penicillium, you know, some of those produce pretty nasty compounds, but when we grew it on, you know, let's say milk for enough time, it said, hey, I don't have to compete. I'm happy. I don't have to produce all this nasty stuff. So I'm chilling. But if you start then saying, hey, you know, and I think some chefs have done that. I mean, and I've started to question this a little bit myself. What does happen when we take it out of its traditional context and put it on a new substrate? We assume it's going to be safe. We assume that it's going to be acting the same, but it's possible to say that we might unlock metabolism that we're not aware of, and we can't often taste or smell the toxins. And so it raises these questions of, okay, maybe genetics should come in and be used, for example, to say this strain has we have completely removed the capacity, even if it's a small, you know, possibility, we have removed the capacity entirely to make something that could be toxic to humans. And so that's definitely, I think, one way we can come in. The other way science comes in is to say, you know, whereas our ancestors couldn't, we didn't have access to DNA sequencing. You know, we didn't have access to AI-based predictions for what molecules are encoded in a genome. Now we can say, okay, let's sequence the DNA and let's look what capacity it has to make any toxins that we're known of. For example, with the fungus from Indonesia, we have taken that approach. We've said, okay, it's been used for hundreds of years, which traditionally is the benchmark to assume safety. But we're also sequenced the genomes of, you know, 20 or so isolates and to say, okay, what is in this genome? Like, does it have the capacity to make anything nasty? And what's very interesting is that in this fungus, it has a very low capacity to make any sort of molecules that you know, are toxic or antibiotics or whatever. So, for example, the fungus that we work on, Neurospora intermedia, we think, oh, this one is probably ideal because it doesn't have any capacity in the first place. And so there, you know, it kind of becomes, maybe we have a little more confidence when we put it on different waste streams that there's not a dormant gene that's going to be activated and unlocked. And then you have the final thing of like, could we go out in nature and just say, hey, this thing grew in soil and grew really well, you know, let's make food from it. I've seen that actually happen in two cases. Corn is a meat substitute produced in, historically, it was made in the UK, Q-U-O-R-N, kind of a weird name. They found that fungus in the soil outside of the factory where they were working. And they had to go through, you know, 20 years of testing to basically prove that even though it has the capacity to make toxins, it doesn't do so when we grow it and make our meat substitute. And more recently, Nature's Find, another alternative meat company based in Chicago, they went to Yellowstone and found a fungus that said, oh, this one grows under, you know, really high temperatures and it tolerates all these extreme conditions. And they have also now turned that into breakfast patties and sausages and, you know, proven that it doesn't produce toxins under any condition that they grow it under. But there, I'm again, could we delete those genes just to be completely safe? That would be my preference.
Let me ask while we're on the subject, just what do all these things taste like? I mean, I mean, with Onchum, you probably know, but, you know, we've heard about Oryza and Luciensis, for Aspergillus. What do you know what these different fungi taste like? And do they taste different in their native state and when grown on different substrates?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe David, you can speak a little bit to Aspergillus. I feel like you've worked with it so deeply for so long and, you know, really have that firsthand experience.
Just the baseline Aspergillus that you would use to make like amazake, which is this Japanese porridge that's, you know, you take your koji, which is rice grown with Aspergillus oryzae, and then you mix it with more cooked rice and you just let it stew in a rice cooker overnight. And then you have it for breakfast, or you can have it as a drink. And all of the amylase that the fungus produces just like completely destroys the starch and get this super sweet, rich, very flavorful kind of morning food, breakfast, if you will. The flavor of that, I've heard it described as raw mushrooms mixed with honeysuckle. There has, if you get a good strain, you'll end up with these kind of wafts of tropical fruit, not like biting into tropical fruit, but like smelling the rind of like an almost ripe papaya or something. And it is fruity, you know, and it is delicious on its own, irrespective of what it can do for other foods or its capacity to produce enzymes or be this useful tool or use its mycelium to knit, you know, particulate matter together. It's tasty in its own right. I've never had onchan. I've grown lots of tempeh today. But tell us what that's like, this orange, fuzzy, kind of scary sounding species. You hear neuro in the same sentence as spora, or the same word. I'm sure it would. Maybe it was the one that set off the writers for Last of Us. Who knows?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think once you see it, you'll be like, oh, this is gentle. You know, this is gentle. But it can sound scary. And I think, you know, part of my work, you know, connecting to that, just this before I describe the flavor, is, you know, working with chefs a lot. And one of the papers we have coming out is to, you know, describe what we could do with it. What is the flavor? What, you know, what sort of techniques could it be useful for, right? And I think that is a way in to build trust and to sort of invite people to say, to try this out, and to break that barrier between neuro, spora, and, you know, actually making food. And so what I've been fascinated about with Neurospora, and I think with fungi in general, is that the flavor changes depending on the substrate and sort of the application. And, you know, one interesting thing is that the mycelium itself, when you grow it, has a pretty neutral flavor, you know, and that's a good thing. If you think about meat alternatives or, you know, fish alternatives, you know, that the starting point is neutral. Blue cheese, you know, for example, is very offensive and very polarizing. And so if you're going to try to make something there, you know, you have more barriers to overcome. So I think that it's a good thing that Neurospora, you know, neutral, a little bit mushroomy, a little bit earthy, but quite mild in sort of its native state. Now, depending on the substrate, all different types of aromas are unlocked. And one of the papers that I just mentioned here with working with chefs, we worked with Alchemist Restaurant in Copenhagen, we grew it on different substrates. And we, you know, worked with the chefs to say, okay, where, you know, what are the flavors? What does it remind us of? And where can we take it? And one of the really striking discoveries is that whereas onchan is made from soy waste, soy milk waste, we were finding that we could grow it on other substrate and generate completely different flavors. For example, we grew it on rice. We say, hey, let's grow it on rice. And the rice was basically liquefied into very sweet sugars, very similar to koji. In fact, we found that it had a even more powerful capacity to break down starch than koji and release it into free glucose, even though it's not its native, you know, application and native kind of recipe. But we put it on there, we were like, whoa, mind blown. And so we made an amasake from it. And so the amasake, which is this kind of rice porridge made from fungal enzymes, made with Neurospora, has a completely different profile. It's sort of, yeah, ripe, I would say ripe fruit, a little earthy, mushroomy, and it has kind of an orange tint to it. And basically the point is to illustrate that you may have, you know, one flavor in one context, in one substrate, in one condition, but depending on how you grow it and the parameters, it will sort of manipulate the metabolism to you know, go in different directions. And one thing my work is trying to understand is, well, what is the molecular basis of that, right? Like, how do we be more rational in that? When we want ripe fruit, how do we steer it in that direction? What is it that controls that? And so, yeah, I'm excited for people, you know, like David and other people in the world to take onchan and experiment and explore, you know, what can it do for them? Kind of onboarding a new fungus for this field.
I have a question that kind of riffs off of this line of thinking of experimentation. You know, we're talking about how these organisms behave when they're taken out of their historical context. You could say they're endemic environments. Yeah. But what happens when they're taken into isolation out of, you know, relation to all the friends that they would normally grow alongside? Like, what happens when you're growing Neurospora in a petri dish or in a like a super clean, sterile batch of soy milk pulp? And, you know, does it behave differently, or do you see different characteristics when you pull it into a laboratory setting versus what goes on in the wild?
That's a really great question. And I think in general, I feel that that's a big unanswered question in the field. It's sort of like, fungal interactions, fungal bacterial interactions, you know, beyond food, how do these things behave when they, you know, are popping out on the forest floor or, you know, making miso versus grown in the laboratory? And sadly, I don't have a straightforward answer to that because I think there's many decades of research that have to be done to really start understanding and disentangling it. But I expect, and we've maybe seen some work from people like Ben Wolf, I think, who will be on the podcast, that there are behaviors that change. You know, you put a bacteria in with a fungus and now the fungus behaves totally differently. And so does the bacteria. And there's all these kind of interactions, particularly we've learned from, I think, cheese as a model system. But how does that translate to, you know, these other kind of ferments? I'm not really sure. One thing that we did find is that even though the on-chump fermentation is not done in a sterile environment whatsoever, it's humid, it's tropical, the Neurospora completely dominates the fermentation. We've used metagenomic sequencing, which is a technique to kind of, you know, without culturing, as a technique that allows you to understand who's living, what kind of microbes are living in a sample, and Neurospora is very, very dominant. And, you know, why and what this means, we're not entirely sure, but we think it has to do with the domestication and the fact that it's been grown so long for the substrate, and every time you make it, you take your previous batch and you put it on the new batch, that this is really kind of leading to a takeover that excludes a lot of other species. You know, excludes a lot of other organisms, fungi, bacteria, and whatsoever. So, you know, in some cases, I think the foods are surprisingly dominated maybe by one, you know, major fungus. But of course, there could be interactions we yet have to understand.
I wanted to briefly ask about domestication. So what exactly is the difference between domestication and selection? Because when I think of the difference between these two processes in the context of passaging from one ferment to another, like when you're making koji, are we really domesticating filamentous fungi, which to me implies some sort of change in the genome to better suit human use or to select for, you know, a trait beneficial to us? So, you know, again, going back to koji with Aspergillus oryzae, you know, no longer produces aflatoxin. Or are you just selecting for a favorable strain by providing it with the perfect environment into which it will outcompete other strains that could be present?
That's a really great question. And I think, you know, some of the work with Aspergillus oryzae has shed light on this particular question. And it's a question I'm really interested in for the future because, you know, if you can understand the trajectories of domestication in the past, we might be able to rationally domesticate species in the future, you know, like, right, to replicate that process and to kind of think about how could we domesticate anything for our use. So one thing with Aspergillus oryzae that we see is that, you know, it's 99% or more identical to a very dangerous fungus called Aspergillus flavus. Aspergillus flavus produces what's called alpha toxin. It's a huge problem in around the world, particularly in the global south, where this fungus, Aspergillus flavus, contaminates grains, for example, and produces toxins, which leads to, you know, liver damage and cancer in people. And Aspergillus oryzae is super closely related to this fungus, yet we've used it to make food for thousands of years. So what happened? So there were some researchers that collected a bunch of Aspergillus flavus, a bunch of Aspergillus oryzae. They sequenced the DNA, the genomes, many years ago, and they found that there are indeed these genomic changes on the DNA level between these two groups. So, for example, Aspergillus oryzae, it seems to have been domesticated. If domestication is the definition that we have modified the genome to suit our needs, for example, I think that's kind of what you're getting at. You know, we see that, okay, Aspergillus oryzae has become a lot better at producing starch. It has all these new pathways to make flavor molecules. It also has lost the ability, when grown on certain substrates, to produce toxins. And so actually on the genetic level, we can see these signatures of adaptation to human environments and human-created fermentations. The same thing is has been very clearly seen in brewer's yeast used to make beer, wine. You know, there's really beautiful work saying, oh, there's yeast that live in fruits, you know, and they eat nectar or sugars in the wild. And then, you know, we've started making beer and wine with them, and they also have genomic changes. Another example is penicillium used to make cheese. We also see these expansion in certain genes, you know, that make them better at growing out milk and maybe reducing off flavors. And so there's quite a rich literature kind of coming out now on like something that's been used, you know, for a lot of time in a certain way by humans seems to also change, the genome seems to change. And that was a finding that was very surprising with Neurospora. We found that that when we looked at Neurospora broadly, we saw that there's two populations of it. One of them that's growing on in the wild, usually after forest fires or after something burns, this fungus will grow. And then there's another population that grows on waste, not just on CHOM, but actually has been found on sugarcane waste, sugarcane fiber, corn cobs, and all sorts of other waste that humans leave behind. It's been collected from all of these areas. And when we compare those two groups, you also see genetic changes between them. For example, the so-called domesticated fungi have much higher cellulose degrading ability. So that's one of the kind of key findings, that it seems that we've changed the genome to maybe be better at breaking down cellulose, which would suit us when we're making food from cellulose-rich waste. So I think now we're starting to understand more and more that, yes, there's genomic signatures, genomic changes, you know, that are a result of human practices and human fermentation. And I find that really intriguing and cool. I mean, we talk about wolves and dogs, right? Like, that's a very obvious example of domestication in our daily lives. Similar things are going on with fungi.
Well, kind of riffing off that, I mean, the obvious analogy to reach for is, of course, yeah, canines. You know, there was lupus lupus, and now we have our, you know, lupus familiaris. And all the changes that humanity has wrought into that species. My favorite, I think, is the like multiple doublings of their ancestral wolf's amylase enzyme production. Like the gene for that has like doubled again and again and again as they ate more and more human food. But maybe a better example for the question I'm about to ask, cats. Like cats didn't really, they were kind of hanging around our waste piles for a long time. And it could be said that like, oh, well, maybe cats are keeping us as pets, you know? Did we ever really invite them into our homes if we could never really train them? Or it's like the benefit was marginal. It's like, sure, they kept the rats away a little bit, but, you know, they kind of run by the beat of their own drum. Are there ways in which we could view, especially in these kind of, you know, ancestral populations of people that have been growing these foods, where instead of us taking something from nature and saying, okay, you're going to work for me now, where something in nature with these fungi kind of latched onto us and said, no, I'm going to change you for my benefit. There is an argument to be made for like the king of this, which is yeast and our love for alcohol and you know, the change of in our own livers to produce alcohol dehydrogenase. But I'm just wondering if there's a similar example from filamentous fungi where we either became attuned to a toxin that they produced, or maybe tastes have changed, or I'm just really curious if there's anything in the literature that you've come across in Southeast Asia that would point to this sort of, you know, mirror domestication event in Homo sapiens.
Well, I mean, I think that does connect really interestingly to Anchom and what we found with Neurospora intermedia, because even though So here's the kind of interesting thing, that it seems from what we found that Neurospora intermedia just grows on waste. It seems to have found a niche that's human byproducts. Okay, so there's these strains out in the wild, you know, they grow with plants on forest fires, whatever. But there seems to be a group that's just growing on sugarcane waste and corn cobs and whatever else humans have left behind. Like, just, it's growing there. And they're And those strains are basically identical to the ones that are used to make onchan. Like, we cannot really genetically distinguish them. And so it leads to the question, kind of, you're saying, maybe they were just hanging out on our waste, and somehow, you know, on soy milk waste, it was growing and it became a food. Like, I really, and because we don't have evidence that there's a difference between the thing that's hanging around on the waste and the thing that's used to convert the waste into onchan. Right. And so I do think there is a really interesting kind of question there, because it's not like the one that grows on waste and it's not made for food produces toxins. And we've sort of selected that away. It's the same. It doesn't make toxins. It has the same kind of color. It has the same kind of spores. We find basically no genetic differences. But yet some of those have then become used for making onchan. So yeah, I think probably there's more than we appreciate. Has there been kind of, hey, I'm growing here and it turns into something, rather than this kind of rational, you know, process. I also wonder with koji, right? And the Aspergillus oryzae kind of, you know, domestication and the way that we've fallen in love with that fungus. I mean, it's really good at making a molecule that we fundamentally love and are programmed to crave and love, which is glutamate. You know, MSG you might have heard of. It's basically a molecule that connects to our receptors in our tongue and gives us a sensation of savory and satisfaction. And it's like eating, you know, it's a similar receptor to sugar, so it sort of gives you a similar pleasure when you consume it. It's round, it's beautiful, round kind of mouth, like a full kind of flavor and dimension to it. And Aspergillus oryzae is just the master of making it, you know, like it just can take soy protein and other forms of proteins and making large amounts of this molecule. So, you know, is that kind of the thing that we just sort of invited us into going crazy and to make more? I mean, certainly chefs today seem to be enamored in this way, right? And just MSG and the umami, the depth that this fungus can bring out. Maybe that was exactly what happened in our past. And I kind of think that brings up a question of like, maybe we try to think of our ancestors as kind of like trial and error randomness, like, oh, look, it grow, whatever. But why wouldn't they be as rational and as curiosity driven as we are? You know, why wouldn't they be like, oh, this is delicious. Have you tried this thing, you know, thousands of years ago and, you know, making all the sorts of experiments, right? Like, I don't see why they wouldn't be like that. Like, why is that a new thing that we are rational and creative and, you know, try this, try that? So I think it brings up kind of a different perspective, you know, David, like you said, that, you know, what is nature guiding us? What is us guiding nature?
You know, I think you guys are hitting on some really interesting points here, because now we talk about fermented foods as quite often as something that's, you know, incredibly healthy. And maybe in the case of a lot of like, you know, bacterial ferments, we talk about lower glycemic index, that the microbes have consumed all the sugar, and you know, you have all these metabolites in their place that are healthy. But you think back evolutionarily to the role, either intentionally or unintentionally, that fermentation played, either in stabilizing food, so you get calories over months where you normally wouldn't, because you've competed out all the bad bugs that would have spoiled the food. Or in this case, maybe with fungal ferments, the case was actually that, you know, if you let your cellulosic matter just kind of sit, suddenly you start turning that into bioavailable calories that you can take. And so you're actually increasing caloric content of the foods from the fermentation. And the conversation about glutamate, you know, you just wonder kind of which direction the selection went in, David, back to your original point. Like, could there be actually, you know, fungi out there that are not taking up glutamate as a way to have, you know, their colony selected and propagated over time, of course, with no foresight, but they hit the lottery in terms of, you know, mutating the receptor that would have taken up glutamate. So there's probably just tons of interesting stories to tell, you know, going back to the genomic information and, you know, some of the studies that you're doing and other people are doing with, you know, just accumulating genomic information about the strains that have been propagated over centuries versus those that are just kind of naturally occurring, and what sort of selections have taken place, and then matching those with the receptors on the host side, you know, the umami receptors and things like that, and just seeing where the yin and yang of these, you know, kind of what we'll say co-evolving, even though it may not technically reach the bar of proof for that right now, these co-evolving species over time.
I mean, you're really hitting on an interesting point there, I think, of like, you know, ferment, why ferment, right? I mean, yeah, there's the preservation aspect, as you said, and there's all these sort of other, I think preservation is the one that people commonly think of, you know, in the public, like in our popular mind, you know, in general, like fermentation, oh, you know, yogurt, it preserves the milk, or cheese, or, you know, vegetables lasting longer for and stuff. But I think there's all these fascinating examples. I think Anchom is one of them, of like, you know, food system circularity, sustainability, or you don't have to preserve soybeans. Soybeans can be stored dried forever. So why ferment them with Aspergillus oryzae, right? What we don't need to per se from a storage perspective, but maybe flavor, maybe nutrition. And there's two kind of interesting examples other that I've also found. Like one of them is from the Darfur region of Sudan. This was a study by a Sudanese scholar in the 80s. Talking about a food named kawal, which is explicitly a fermented legume used in times of meat shortage to mimic meat jerky. And so it's basically this beautiful study of like, they'll take these wild legumes, put them in a giant vat, and it turns into like a very savory paste that then is informed into balls and dried in the sun. And the idea is basically, you know, this is a nomadic tribe that doesn't always have access to, you know, beef and meat. And the idea is, hey, when we don't have meat, we eat kawal. We eat this imitation beef jerky that's enabled by fermentation, right? And they say the benefit of eating this over beef is we can eat as much as we want without getting sick. So, you know, that's not about preservation, or it's about sustainability. It's about solving a question of meat scarcity. Another really interesting example from the 1950s is using fermentation to parboil rice. So it's an example from Ecuador where rice is grown in the low-lying valleys, but it's consumed up in the Andes at 4,000 meters of altitude. And cooking rice at that altitude takes really long because of the pressure, and you know, you can't really reach the temperature. So there's this amazing study that discovered that what they do is they will just pile up the rice once it's harvested and let it ferment and basically turn into rice compost. And the heat from that process parboils the rice. It pre-cooks it. So then you can dry it and bring it up to the elevation, and it will boil in much, much less time. So fermentation, you know, as a vehicle beyond preservation, as David said, you know, changing our culture, changing our minds, but also like solving these interesting challenges, right? These sustainability challenges. And so I'm very inspired to think broadly about, okay, we're talking about, oh, you know, meat, we have to stop eating meat, we have to change how we eat. There's so much to learn because people have used fermentation exactly for this purpose, even though we might not commonly know that or learn about it in school. There's all these beautiful examples. And so there's a lot to learn and understand there.
Those are some really, really fun examples, not all of which I've known before. The anecdote about the Ecuadorian rice compost is really fun.
Isn't that so cool? I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, but it makes a lot of sense. The only time I've ever heard something similar to that was from Darwin's travels in South America, and he complained about not being able to eat potatoes at altitude because they never cooked through. So maybe if he just fermented them too.
Yeah, just ferment them.
He would solve that problem.
That's so interesting. I do have a question that I think both you, David, and Vayu could address. And this is going back to when we were having the discussion about companies and this really exciting innovation that's coming out in terms of the use of mycelium for sustainability and as a meat substitute. I feel like a few years ago, we were really sold this vision that mycelium was going to be the next big thing in the sustainable food industry. but it never felt like it quite took off, especially in grocery stores. You hear a lot about it, but I haven't really seen that many new products on the shelves. And you still have companies like Quorn that have been around for a while. And it seems like in terms of academia and R&D, there's exciting stuff coming out. But I'm not just not seeing a lot of these new mycelium-based meat alternatives on shelves. And I'm wondering if you have some insight into what might have happened or what is happening in terms of the fields. Are there just some really important biological questions that we're missing that still need to be addressed before being able to move forward?
I can go first, maybe, David, and you can, you know, join in. I kind of feel like as a lot of, you know, as often happens in, you know, venture-funded Silicon Valley kind of, you know, startup world, I think over-promising and under-delivering, you know. Here's the next generation, this and this. We can fundamentally, you know, change it, da-da-da. But if it, you know, tastes and or if it looks like freeze-dried diarrhea and tastes off-putting, you know, you're not going to, you know, no matter how good the story is, no matter how amazing your life cycle analysis looks like, it's just not going to take off. And so, you know, part of me feels like flavor has really been missing. And, you know, David can speak more, but, you know, the role of chefs, the role of kind of cultural and culinary sensitivity in this new era, you know, it can't just be lab. You know, it has to be food is more than just the components, right? Soylent, you know, tried to do this many years ago, but how do we kind of connect to the cultural dimension, the flavor dimension, the, you know, the other kind of sensitivities that we have around food? I think that's something that I felt was missing a little bit from this, like, biotech to food. And a lot of these companies, you know, were run by people or started by people who have never worked in food and, you know, like, don't know anything about this field. And I think that's something maybe that was missing. And I think on top of it, you know, huge boom and explosion in industry, yet there's like a handful of mycology labs in universities in the US. You know, like, there's a huge mismatch behind the incredible, like, excitement of mycelium, this and that. And then it's like, who's doing the research? You know, who's training the people to actually work with these organisms? And I feel like there's just so much we have to do in training people in this field, you know, learning about these very complicated organisms that are nothing like yeast, you know, they're their own creatures, very complex and difficult to handle, and studying them and understanding them to really kind of power the next wave. You know, that, I think, has been a big, big mismatch. You know, everybody wants mycelium. You know, I'm one of the few people who's working on this at UC Berkeley. All the mycelium professors have retired, you know. It's kind of a field that's dying a little bit in terms of the academic side, yet it's been exploding outside. So, you know, big push there to fund and support kind of this new wave of research. David, I don't know what your take is from your standpoint.
You know, I'll just say that, you know, to hark back to what you were saying before, Vayu, why do people ferment? So often people ferment because they want to, because it's delicious, because there is no benefit to, like, putting in the work of transforming this food. There is no, I mean, often with, you know, filamentous fungi, koji in particular, you know, you can put in 2 days of work and end up with this product that is, it'd have a different nutritional profile than rice, but there's no, like, inherent preservation aspect to just growing koji. But people do it, and people eat it fresh, and people make amazake because they love the flavor of it. So we can't forget that, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, Darwin's theory of like, sexual selection. It's like, never discredit an organism's ability to choose beauty for beauty's sake or deliciousness for deliciousness' sake. That is a driver in its own right, evolutionarily. And to that point, you know, to address Elisa's question, I think that is something that's been missing a lot in this space, is that as amazing as the ideas or the biotechnologies behind some of these foods, behind corn, you know, searching for organisms like Fusarium, finding incredibly novel ways to grow them, bioreactors, purifying them, filamentous fungi, you know, there's these koji bacons and these breakfast patties and sausages and stuff. But a lot of times they put a spin on the product and say, oh, well, you know, it's a really blank canvas for whatever flavors you want to cook into your food, which is another way of saying it's bland, which is another way of saying that, like, if you don't have a very rich and flavorful substrate there already, this mycelium isn't going to taste of much when it comes out of the bioreactor, which is exactly the case with corn. Corn tastes like nothing. I remember doing kind of a masterclass for my old boss, Dan Giusti, who has this kind of new company trying to put chefs into school food programs to really improve like food from scratch cooking. And I was like, okay, if we're, you know, trying to keep costs low, let's cook with corn. And in the R&D for that session, I was shocked at how much flavor I had to pump into it to make it taste like something a seventh grader would eat. And that is, you know, the point. Like, I hate to credit Burger King for one of the best slogans ever, but taste is king. And if, you know, some of these engineers aren't finding really clever ways to get the mycelium to grow, but also harness their enzymes at the same time to reach those peaks of their potential, you're just not going to convince consumers that, like, novel is better for novelty's sake. It has to be as delicious as what they perceive they're giving up. And, you know, in a lot of what I've tried, that's where it lags behind. It's not to say that fungi can't be delicious. I think mushrooms are incredibly delicious. I love filamentous fungi. I love filamentous ferments. But you have to be very clever about how you approach them, especially for Western markets that aren't necessarily used to these flavors on the center of the plate. You know, these are organisms that bind a lot of water, that can have very low protein content just on their own. So to be able to make that as impressive as possible, you either have to combine it with other domains of life, soybeans, legumes, things like that, and then allow them to process it, or find other ways of concentrating it, which is usually evaporation or Maillard reactions or pumping flavor in some other way.
You know, when you work at Noma, the fermentation lab, and just kind of, you know, feel like a lot of fine dining and chefs have been very successful in harnessing fungi to make things incredibly delicious. And, you know, just right and left are saying, you know, demonstrating you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. I mean, it's just amazing the things that have come out of these of these places. And so I don't really, you know, there's some that shows the ceiling. I think that shows, like, really the possibilities. And so it's just the challenge for these very tech focused companies is to incorporate some of that thinking and learn from those examples, I think.
So what are biological questions the field still needs to address in order to scale up or to guarantee that these products are ready for consumers?
Do we have an extra hour? I'm just kidding. I mean, the list is very, very long. I think, you know, compared to other microorganisms, filamentous fungi are vastly understudied and poorly understood. As I said, there's very few labs that are not medical mycology or agricultural pest, but are just focusing on understanding and unraveling this world. So the list is very long. I think understanding flavor, you know, enzymes, pathways that sort of lead to certain outcomes, right? To have a deeper understanding of that. I think domestication is something we hit on. You know, what are the events that lead to fungus being useful? And it, you know, can we learn from that to think about how they might be useful in the future? I think collaborations between biotechnology and gastronomy or chefs, critical too. You know, that's maybe not a biological question, but there's a lot of kind of learning that happens on both sides. And, you know, really kind of bridging these two worlds. And that's something I hope to do more of as I progress in my career, is to say, hey, we found this fungus. You know, what can we do with it? You know, how can we learn together? And even working with chefs to discover and come up with the questions in the first place. I've just been inspired to see, you know, where their curiosity and questioning inspires us as scientists to be like, oh, I don't actually understand that thing. I have no idea. And then finally, a big one that I'm hoping to make a focus on my future research lab is genetic tools. You know, genetics as a way to both understand to say, hey, we think this gene is making this delicious flavor. Let's knock it out and verify that, right? So genetic is a way to study and understand the fungal world beyond the few model species that have always been used. And genetics to engineer, you know, genetics to control and say, let's remove that toxin that usually isn't on, but could be on. So let's remove it. Or let's entirely reprogram the flavor or nutritional value of this fungus. Let's make it more fatty so that it, you know, tastes juicier in our mouth. I think those are kind of really big long-term and questions that need to be solved and addressed.
And then Vaya, this has been great. Maybe just as a wrap up here, it'd be wonderful to hear kind of your outlook for the future, both maybe quickly for the field, but also just for your own research, a way for people maybe to connect to your work, if there's a place they can go to learn more about it. You know, you've mentioned the funding challenges of this field, working with fungi and kind of the cliff in basic sciences for research like this. I think one of the things on the horizon that I see and that you've mentioned a few times is the importance of sustainability. And, you know, just thinking to Stanford put in a whole new school, a fourth school focused entirely on sustainability and what that might mean kind of in terms of a signal in the field for both infusion of funding, but also focus on this research and kind of how that fits into how you see things playing forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of my own research, I'm hoping to keep going and I'm applying to faculty positions, you know, to really formalize this type of work that I've been doing and really build the bridges between biotech and gastronomy and, you know, continue just investigating and understanding filamentous fungi with the eye towards sustainability. I mean, that's really a big driver for me. And I think there's all these other learnings that have, you know, relevance for all sorts of other areas, you know, health or, you know, energy and whatever, but really kind of thinking about food and sustainability because that's my background. Yeah, I think that, you know, where you can follow my work is, you know, follow me on Instagram, VayuMR, VayuMister basically, or my website, VayuHillMiney.com. You know, I'll post my papers and discussion on those through those channels. And then I think in terms of the future, yeah, funding is a big question. I'm seeing more kind of funding, maybe not so much federal yet, but definitely private foundations, you know, the Bezos Earth Foundation, you're seeing the Gates Foundation starting to look at it a little bit and saying, oh, this is important, right? DARPA had a call last year for microbially designed foods, you know, that could be created from minimal inputs and are delicious, probably towards kind of defense applications and, you know, wartime situations. So I think I'm starting to see these bubble, but I think where Stanford, for example, establishing a school of sustainability, it's saying, hey, this is important, this is real, and we need to focus on it. And I just hope we'll see more of that kind of commitment from philanthropy, from private actors, as well as the government in the future. Because that's what we need. You know, this is urgent, this is critical. And, you know, I'm really excited to be part of this, you know, the initiatives like this that sort of showcase the importance of this field. And I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, Vayu, thanks for that great conversation. That was incredibly enlightening and gives me great hope for the future, both in terms of the foods I'll be eating, but also the research that I'll be seeing.
Thank you so much for joining us for our conversation with Dr. Vayu Hillmaini. For more information, visit us at go.stanford.edu/fermentation-series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.